democracy becomes increasingly unwieldy and inefficient as the population grows. Although the noble goal of democracy had been tried by other societies, power usually eventually shifted to some central authority and the dream of autonomy died. Even with the well-established system of democracy created by the ancient Israelites, the people became dissatisfied and demanded a king. Without question, when one has a central authority figure, the squabbling and arguments quickly die out, and it is easier to get things done. The Founding Fathers understood this tendency and endeavored to create a system that would resist the urge to become a monarchy. Yes, there had been benevolent kings and queens, but they had experienced firsthand a monarch who cared not for the populace at large. This process of developing a government that could utilize the power bestowed on it by the people to govern effectively but efficiently was tricky business. These men had witnessed the tyranny of monarchs and the ineffectiveness and inequality of large governments, and they recognized that a democracy would quickly stagnate if everybody had to weigh in on every decision. Therefore, they decided that a republic-type government would be much more efficient, in which the elected representatives of the people would make decisions. Also, with a republic, there is no limitation on expansion. A republic, by which I mean a government in which the scheme of representation takes place, stated James Madison in the Federalist Papers, opens a different prospect and promises the cure for which we are seeking. A republic, he further defined, is a government which derives all its powers, directly or indirectly, from the great body of the people, and is administered by persons holding their offices during pleasure for a limited period or during good behavior. It is essential to such a government that it be derived from the great body of the society, not from an inconsiderable proportion or a favored class of it. Otherwise, a handful of tyrannical nobles, exercising their oppressions by a delegation of their powers, might aspire to the rank of republicans and claim for their government the honorable title of republic. In other words, if this new government was to survive and flourish down through the centuries, it would need a way to prevent the abuse of power. The checks and balances, please. At the Constitutional Convention, where the U.S. Constitution was drafted, the founders decided to divide power within the federal government to ensure that it would not be controlled by just one man or one group. Three divisions or branches were the result: the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, each of which has duties concerning the law. The job of the legislative branch, which consists of the House of Representatives and the Senate, is to create laws when necessary, and there was never any intention that they would just sit around arbitrarily creating laws, particularly laws that benefited special interest groups. The executive branch, which includes the president, the vice president, the office of the attorney general, and the departments governed by each of the cabinet secretaries, all execute the laws provided by the legislative branch. All cabinet-level appointments were to be confirmed by the Senate, and there was no provision for the appointment of czars, as we have today to oversee the implementation of policies ranging from the recovery of the U.S. auto industry to the doling out of economic stimulus, without official oversight. Finally, the judicial branch interprets the laws. In recent decades, however, we have seen more activism by the judicial branch, which is why there is so much bickering surrounding each nomination to the Supreme Court. Each and every political persuasion wants someone appointed who is philosophically aligned with them, with the hope that the judge's activism will work in their favor. Again, this was not the original intention of the Founding Fathers, and it is a good reason why we need to consider term limits for Supreme Court justices. Each of the three branches has the ability to impact the activities of the other two, creating a system of checks and balances. This was an ingenious system created by our founders to help avoid the kinds of tyrannical governmental systems from which they had fled. As long as we maintain a degree of balance in the three branches of our government, we are unlikely to tilt too far in one direction or the other, thereby destroying our democracy. In framing a government, which is to be administered by men over men, James Madison pointed out, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Why three branches? The idea was birthed in the writings of Baron Charles Montesquieu, a French social and legal philosopher, scholar, and writer. Montesquieu wrote the highly influential book, The Spirit of Laws. This book greatly impacted the formation of the American government, as it was read and studied intently in America. He was the most frequently quoted source, next to the Bible. In it, Montesquieu acknowledges the deceit and wickedness of the human heart, as shown in Jeremiah 17:9, and advocates for a system that tries to check and moderate mankind's worst excesses by dividing power into three parts. His inspiration came from Isaiah 33:22, which states, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king." The real genius in the system of checks and balances established by the founders is that the executive branch, the branch most likely to become too powerful and king-like, is checked by the other two branches of government that did not want to be minimized. And in order for the system to be truly representative of the people, the representatives were intended to be integral members of their communities. The constituents of the House of Representatives and Senate were to be farmers, teachers, nurses, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, pharmacists, and, well, you get the picture. They were to represent every segment of society so that everyone's interest would be represented fairly. As long as you have broad representation from many parts of society, representative government works extremely well. And it works even better when the representatives serve for only a short period of time and return to their communities, leaving a spot for someone else from the community to become the next representative. Checks out of balance. A couple of things can severely interfere with the efficacy of this system of checks and balances, however. One is when an elected representative becomes entrenched and wants to keep returning to the House of Representatives, becoming progressively less connected with the community that he or she represents. Although the Founding Fathers thought of many things, they failed to realize that the facet of human nature that makes people strive for power and influence might result in it becoming very difficult for them to give up their seat in the House of Representatives once they had it. The other detrimental thing is having one profession or group of individuals being overly represented. If there were too many doctors serving in and or represented in government, there would probably be an overabundance of health-related legislation. Likewise, if there were too many farmers, there would likely be an abundance of agricultural legislation. Perhaps as you've been reading, you've wondered why a neurosurgeon is sharing his ideas about government when the training, education, and focus of a neurosurgeon's life is decidedly scientific and concerns biomedical dilemmas and solutions. You might be surprised to know that four physicians signed the Declaration of Independence, and many of them were involved with the creation of the United States Constitution. I believe it is a very good idea for physicians, scientists, engineers, and others trained to make decisions based on facts and empirical data to get involved in the political arena and help guide our country. Physicians were once much more involved in their communities and with governance in general. But in recent years, we have tended to spend all of our time in our operating rooms, clinics, laboratories, and professional societies, leaving the governance to others. This is a mistake, because we should be concerned not only about the health of individual patients, but also about the health of our entire society. Since those in the healthcare professions are among the most highly trained people in our society, a typical physician spends an average of over 5 years in postgraduate training, we should be willing to share the benefits of our education and critical thinking with the society that made it possible. As it stands today, we have too many lawyers in government, many of whom are very smart and decent people, but they are not immune from acting like lawyers. Consequently, we have far too much regulatory legislation. Also, what do many lawyers learn in law school? They learn to win by hook or by crook. It doesn't matter how you fight, as long as you win. Imagine a room full of Democratic and Republican lawyers, each with one overriding goal to win. And this certainly helps one understand the distasteful partisan politics that characterizes Congress today. That unintended fourth branch of government. Having three well-balanced branches of government was an inspired and creative idea. But I do not believe that the Founding Fathers intended for a fourth branch of government to emerge, that of special interest groups. These groups would not have the great power they do today in the scenario originally envisioned by the Founding Fathers, in which dedicated citizens served in Congress for a few years and then returned to their original walks of life. But because many in Congress want to keep returning term after term, they need to constantly campaign and seek funding, much of which is obtained from special interest groups. Needless to say, money from these groups is not given without strings being attached. These tangled relationships have reached the point now where powerful corporate groups, unions, and other groups with large amounts of money to spend can exert great influence on the legislative process, which essentially pitches logical solutions to problems out the proverbial window and favors solutions that benefit the special interest groups. This is an extremely serious problem, which threatens the very integrity of our system of government. I suspect that if the Founding Fathers were suddenly resurrected and saw the current situation, they would mandate a constitutional convention to find a solution to this problem post-haste. One solution to the problem of special interest groups might be to lengthen the term one serves as a representative from 2 years to 6, 8, or even 10 years, with no possibility of re-election. You could couple that term length with a right of recall by the populace every other year if the representative were doing an exceptionally bad job. Congressmen could then govern based on the wishes of their constituents and pay little or no attention to special interest groups. Can you even imagine how much more efficiently and logically our government would work under such a circumstance? A few years ago, my friend Dr. Henry Brim, who is the chairman of the neurosurgery department at Johns Hopkins, and I wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post, focusing on tort reform. In that piece, we called for the media to focus attention on the United States senators who had been co-opted by the Trial Lawyers Association to the point that they would always filibuster any tort reform bill that came before the Senate. This is certainly an example of how the media could be very helpful by exposing not only the special interest groups and what they are doing, but also the leaders who are being influenced by them. Revealing this practice could discourage such close relationships between our elected officials and special interest groups. The Founding Fathers certainly feared government becoming too big and too powerful. Observing this imbalance overseas, Thomas Jefferson wrote in a letter, "Experience declares that man is the only animal which devours his own kind, for I can apply no milder term to the governments of Europe and to the general prey of the rich on the poor." When the American experiment appeared to be preparing to return to big government rule, ex-President George Washington wrote to Justice John Jay, astounded that the ideals that had been agonized over, rehashed, and reworked had fallen into a whirlpool of indifference. He wrote, "What astonishing changes a few years are capable of producing. I am told that even respectable characters speak of a monarchical form of government without horror. From thinking proceeds speaking. Thence to acting is often but a single step. But how irrevocable and tremendous. What a triumph for the advocates of despotism to find that we are incapable of governing ourselves and that systems founded on the basis of equal liberty are merely ideal and fallacious. Would to God that wise measures may be taken in time to avert the consequences we have but too much reason to apprehend." The founders realized that a gigantic government would require increasingly large amounts of resources from the people in the form of taxes, and that the people would consequently expect more from such a government since they were giving it so much of their money. Eventually, government could become so big that its ravenous appetite for tax money, coupled with a populace that expects so much from it, creates a bloated, unsustainable system, no longer able to provide for itself. Many of the countries from which the Founding Fathers fled could be characterized in just this way, which is why they were so rightly concerned the United States would fall prey to the same problems. Certainly, the plight of such countries as Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain have received a lot of attention in recent years due to significant public outcries, demonstrations, and even riots because their governments have not been able to fulfill their promised social obligations to the people due to lack of funds despite high tax rates. We cannot ask for more timely examples of what happens when we abandon our founding principles of limited government and protecting individual rights. Our freedoms, a system built to change with the times. The Founding Fathers also knew they needed to design a system that would give the people flexibility to alter the government if it became too bloated. Freedom of speech and freedom of the press, as well as the right to peacefully assemble, were among the key provisions included to preserve our freedom. In many societies around the world, criticism of the government can result in imprisonment or death. In America, however, criticism occurs on a daily basis. In fact, our free press is one of the real virtues of American society. One of the greatest journalists of all time was Walter Cronkite, whose integrity was never questioned. Although his political leanings were decidedly left-wing, you would have had great difficulty detecting it because of his balanced treatment of the news. I do not want to be overly critical of the news media today because I realize what a difficult task they have reporting news around the clock. When one has all day to talk about the news, and one has to talk about the news all day, it is hard not to offer personal commentary and, at times, embellish. Nevertheless, we the people should expect integrity from the news media and unbiased reporting of newsworthy events. When a news reporter or commentator can tell a flat-out lie and not be terminated or even required by the network to offer a public apology, we have a problem. I am still a big fan of our news media, however, and I certainly hope they can take corrective action on their own to preserve a noble profession. The freedoms built into our Constitution actually give us power to dramatically change things about our society with which we disagree. For instance, in the 1950s and 1960s, segregation and racial discrimination were rampant in America. The populace became increasingly discontent with the glaring injustices they witnessed nightly on television. Many nonviolent protests were carried out, and the media did a magnificent job of highlighting the shortcomings of both federal and local governments in resolving the situation. As a result of these social movements and the courage of many individuals, a whole way of life that was a scourge upon our nation was changed. Protest and the media were also instrumental in ending the Vietnam War. As long as we have a courageous populace and a courageous and unbiased media, we are likely to be able to correct significant societal problems as they arise, which is a part of the greatness of America. Unfortunately, political correctness threatens the integrity of the media, and we must all be vigilant in our attempt to continue the great experiment that is America. Is this a government by the people, for the people? The kind of government proposed by the framers of our Constitution was intended to serve the people. This meant providing protection, adequate infrastructure, the right to make a living, and the right to pursue happiness. The kind of government that the framers did not want was one that tried to control the lives of its constituents. They realized that the latter type of government would transform we the people from a can-do society to a what-can-you-do-for-me society. It is really quite phenomenal how quickly America went from a lowly colony to the very pinnacle nation of the world. It happened because so many people were willing to work hard, not so much for themselves as for their children and their grandchildren. Many of them had immigrated from countries where hard work did not pay off, and they were excited to be in a place where they could actually realize the fruits of their own labor in a tangible way, improving the possibilities for their offspring. Those who propelled our nation to pinnacle status in a very short period of time also knew the importance of sacrifice. Now, it sometimes seems, our government leaders do not understand the concept of sacrifice. They have no problem with the populace sacrificing, but our federal government does not seem to know how to tighten its own belt, preferring to simply raise taxes to cover its own excesses. This would not be the case if our representatives in Congress were more in tune with their constituency. The current government is akin to a person who checks into a hotel and discovers that all of his bills are being taken care of by someone else, and so he feels free to live it up. As long ago as 1791, Thomas Paine noted a similar situation in the governments of Europe. In his book, The Rights of Man, he observed the following. If from the more wretched parts of the old world, we look at those which are in an advanced stage of improvement, we still find the greedy hand of government thrusting itself into every corner and crevice of industry and grasping the spoil of the multitude. Invention is continually exercised to furnish new pretenses for revenues and taxation. It watches prosperity as its prey and permits none to escape without tribute. Several of our founders had very strong opinions on this type of taxation. To take from one, Thomas Jefferson wrote in a letter, because it is thought his own industry and that of his fathers has acquired too much in order to spare to others, who or whose fathers have not exercised equal industry and skill, is to violate arbitrarily the first principle of association, the guarantee to everyone the free exercise of his industry and the fruits acquired by it. Taxation is not the only way in which the government is out of step with the lives and wishes of the people. The overwhelming majority of Americans want the southern borders of our country secured and our immigration laws enforced. But several administrations recently have been unwilling to get tough on this issue because they do not want to alienate a large voting bloc of Latinos. This is yet another area where our government's leadership and the wishes of many of the people diverge and the people are being ignored. When a government turns from following the will of its people to willing its people to follow, acting according to its own prerogatives, it ceases to be a representative government and instead has transformed into something else. One need only look back to one of our most foundational governing documents, the Declaration of Independence, to hear the founders' original intent for our nation. Governments are instituted among men, wrote Thomas Jefferson, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Our unique governing process was laid out clearly and concisely in our Constitution, and for centuries, it has successfully withstood the test of time. Because of its clear instructions for the transfer of power, administrations from our different parties have always transitioned smoothly, unlike most other countries. But political and economic stability over a long period of time can breed complacency among its people. And Jefferson cautioned us that a government should be by the people. Every government degenerates, he wrote in his book Notes on the State of Virginia, when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. The people themselves, therefore, are its only safe depositories. And in order to serve as those safe depositories, we the people must keep ourselves informed and abreast of the actions of our governing leaders, speak out, and vote accordingly, lest our government lead us somewhere we have no desire to go. Chapter 3. Are we a Judeo-Christian nation or not? In April of 1999, the world was shocked by the horrific murders at Columbine High School in Colorado. Some very close friends of ours were so deeply moved by the tragedy that they dedicated much of their lives and their substantial financial resources to making sure that good came out of the situation. This extraordinary couple gained the trust of the families who lost children in the shooting, as well as school officials and legal representatives, and they established a charity to promote character building in schools as a deterrent to the type of behavior that Columbine High had suffered. The program plan was for students to select 13 of the most desirable, positive character traits in honor of the 13 victims and in keeping with the 13 colonies of the American Revolution, each of which was associated with an historical figure, such as Honesty and Abe Lincoln. Students exemplifying these character traits would be rewarded each year. Due to my close relationship with these friends, and because I do a lot of public speaking for schools and educational organizations, I was asked to be the keynote speaker at Columbine for the rollout of the new program. I have spoken to all types of groups throughout this nation and many other parts of the world, but there was something particularly special about speaking at the site of such an infamous, evil event. Before actually going to the school, I met some who had survived the shooting as well as family members of victims. It seemed as if I knew them already, since there had been so much publicity surrounding each victim. The brother of one of the young ladies who was killed, and who had narrowly escaped with his own life, was particularly articulate and a fabulous spokesperson for the group. He was a devout person of faith and a tremendous encouragement to me. When I first stepped on campus, I noticed that the school's hallways were incredibly sterile. There were no stickers, graffiti, or any other signs of the myriad ways that high school students usually decorate their environment. It had indeed become a war zone. I was told by some of the officials that all graffiti had been removed to ensure that no one was frightened or influenced to join a group that was not completely wholesome. One of the officials indicated to me that they knew I was a man of faith, but that it would not be appropriate for me to talk about God or Jesus Christ. Although I did not show it outwardly, I was stunned, because I thought Columbine High School would be the last place on earth where I would hear such an admonition. Those officials were not bad people, quite the contrary, but they were extremely afraid of creating controversy or being blamed for what had occurred. I could tell that some of the administrators did not agree with this policy, but they wanted to maintain the harmony. I don't usually get nervous before a speech, but in this particular case, I had received so many warnings about what not to say due to the sensitivity of the audience that I was off my game. The program was beautifully organized by our friends, the school officials, and students, and I was already quite inspired by the time I took the podium in the gymnasium before the entire school body, parents, officials, and the media. I spoke a bit about hardship and how it can be an advantage if one does not become a victim. I also commented about resilience and how success is frequently preceded by failure. But at the conclusion, I had to talk about God and the very godly principles that resulted in the establishment of our great nation. At the end, I received a standing ovation from an incredibly enthusiastic crowd, and I knew that I had done the right thing by not hiding my faith or denying the principles that have led to well-functioning, harmonious communities throughout our nation. Was I aware that I was violating the established protocols for the program? Of course I was. But I also knew that the whole purpose of the program was to promote character. And if I denied my faith, I would be manifesting a total lack of character. For the sake of pleasing a few, I would have disappointed many. One of the reasons public institutions would rather exclude God is to avoid offending others and creating controversy. They do not want Jews to be offended by the mention of the name Jesus Christ, nor do they want Muslims to be offended by the Torah, nor Christians to be offended by treks to Mecca. The story of Abraham is well known to Jews, Christians, and Muslims. He is referred to as the father in all three religions. Yet, even though there is a common ancestor, human nature and the desire for superiority has turned these differences into cause for war and mayhem. Historically, millions of people have been killed in the name of religion. The brutality associated with the Crusades, the Muslim conquest, the French Wars of Religion, the Reconquista, and more recently, the Jihad, illustrate how strongly people can feel about their religion. But can all this religious fervor be channeled in a positive rather than negative way? As a Christian, I am not the least bit offended by the beliefs of Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, and so forth. In fact, I am delighted to know that they believe in something that is more likely to make them into a reasonable human being, as long as they don't allow the religion to be distorted by those seeking power and wealth. Those in positions of leadership in our society must familiarize themselves with the religions of all their citizens, and they must begin to emphasize the commonalities that unite us as people of faith. Common objectives, placed on the forefront of public policies, will help people work together and bond us together as a nation in spite of our religious differences. Another example that caused me to contemplate the question, are we a Judeo-Christian nation or not, was when I was asked to deliver the keynote address at the 1997 Presidential Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. This is, of course, a great honor, for the audience consists not only of the president, vice president, and their families, but Supreme Court justices, United States senators and congressmen, as well as ambassadors and dignitaries from every walk of life from all over the world. I became familiar with the Secret Service through many calls and emails, and everything had to be scripted down to the second. They had a hard time believing I was a spontaneous speaker and did not use notes. I was pretty excited about the speech until someone said to me that I should not mention the name of Jesus Christ. That seemed like a very strange request for a prayer breakfast. In the receiving line and the pre-breakfast reception, the first time that I met President Clinton and his wife as well as the Gore family, my entire family had the opportunity to shake hands with the president and vice president, as well as meet many people you usually see only on the national evening news. When it was my turn to speak, I briefly recounted my rise from inner-city poverty to the esteemed halls of Johns Hopkins. I talked about how education cultivates human potential, and I spoke about integrity, particularly in public office. Coincidentally, I delivered this speech just before the Monica Lewinsky situation became public. The president must have been wondering, does he know what's going on? Obviously, I did not know. But even if I had, I would have still made the same remarks. President Clinton, like all of us, had some weaknesses, which got him into trouble. He is not the first public figure to have such troubles, and certainly will not be the last. I suspect he would have been better served if he had simply confessed his wrongdoing and asked for forgiveness. But that, of course, is much easier said than done. Students of American history may recall that Alexander Hamilton had an affair while in public office, but when he quickly confessed publicly and was forgiven, the issue was pushed aside, much to the consternation of the mistress and her husband who were planning to blackmail Mr. Hamilton. I finished the speech with my philosophy for success in life, which includes strong faith in God and my Savior, Jesus Christ. The response was overwhelming, and the standing ovation lasted for several minutes, throwing the program off its strict time schedule. The president, in typical Clinton-esque style, took the microphone and asked, "Who's responsible for putting this guy on the program before me?" To which the crowd responded with raucous laughter. I subsequently got tons of mail complimenting me on what many felt was the best presidential prayer breakfast address they had ever heard. Out of the thousands of people at the breakfast and millions of people who heard the address, I received only one negative response for using the name of Jesus. This tells me that the level of tolerance for religious differences is much greater than the politically correct crowd would have us believe. Founding Father, full of faith. But what did the founders of our nation believe? Were they Christian believers in God, or were they deists? A deist believes in God as a first cause, a clockmaker who set up the universe to operate on its own. Deists do not believe in a God who intervenes in this world. By that standard, George Washington was by no means a deist. In George Washington's Sacred Fire, the former president is quoted in a letter written in May of 1789 to the General Assembly of Presbyterian Churches in the United States. "While I reiterate the professions of my dependence upon heaven as the source of all public and private blessings, I will observe that the general prevalence of piety, philanthropy, honesty, industry, and economy seems, in the ordinary course of human affairs, particularly necessary for advancing and conforming the happiness of our country. While all men within our territories are protected in worshiping the deity according to the dictates of their consciences, it is rationally to be expected from them in return that they will be emulous of evincing, striving to prove, the sanctity of their professions by the innocence of their lives and the beneficence of their actions. For no man who is profligate in his morals or a bad member of the civil community can possibly be a true Christian or a credit to his own religious society. The founding father of our country was definitely a believer in the God of the Bible, a man not only of tremendous intellect, but of conscience, caring, dedication, and faith. And his faith was founded on experience. One particularly interesting account occurred on July 9, 1755, during the French and Indian War. George Washington was with the British troops under General Edward Braddock on their way to Fort Duquesne, where they were ambushed by the French. The Brits were being slaughtered, since they were only accustomed to fighting in open fields. To deliver orders from General Braddock to the troops, Washington rode horseback back and forth across the battle. Every other officer on horseback except Washington was shot down. Even General Braddock was killed, at which point the troops fled in confusion. After the battle, on July 18, 1755, Washington wrote to his brother, John A. Washington, "But by the all-powerful dispensations of Providence, I have been protected beyond all human probability or expectation, for I had 4 bullets through my coat, and 2 horses shot under me, yet escaped unhurt, although death was leveling my companions on every side of me." 15 years later, Washington and Dr. Craig, a close friend of his from his youth, were traveling through those same woods near the Ohio River and Great Kanawha River. There, they were met by an old Indian chief who addressed Washington through an interpreter. "I am a chief and ruler of my tribes. My influence extends to the waters of the Great Lakes and to the far Blue Mountains. I have traveled a long and weary path that I might see the young warrior of the great battle. It was on the day when the white men's blood mixed with the streams of our forest that I first beheld this chief, Washington. I called to my young men and said, 'Mark yon tall and daring warrior. He is not of the Redcoat tribe. He hath an Indian's wisdom, and his warriors fight as we do, himself alone exposed. Quick, let your aim be certain, and he dies.' Our rifles were leveled, rifles which but for you knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain. A power mightier far than we shielded you. Seeing you were under the special guardianship of the Great Spirit, we immediately ceased to fire at you. I am old, and soon shall be gathered to the great council fire of my fathers in the land of shades. But ere I go, there is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen. The Great Spirit protects that man, pointing at Washington, and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. I am come to pay homage to the man who is the particular favorite of heaven, and who can never die in battle." The famous Indian warrior who was in that battle said, "Washington was never born to be killed by a bullet. I had 17 fair fires at him with my rifle, and after all, could not bring him to the ground." Why was this history removed from school textbooks, which had included it up until 1934? An incredible story as it may seem, it demonstrates the effect of having faith in God, for a person, or even for a country. As George Washington himself said, "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favors." Escaping prejudices, pursuing liberties. Many of the colonists had fled Europe to escape prejudices and to enjoy the liberty of worshiping according to their beliefs. But this was not necessarily the case for others, and George Washington was more open-minded than most in embracing those who had come to the New World for other reasons. One of his good friends, Haim Salomon, had emigrated from Poland in 1772 after having traveled throughout Europe. In a time when Jews were thought of as Shylocks and money grubbers, George Washington recognized the solid character of Haim. At that time, Congress was trying to fund the war, but did not have power to directly tax the people or states. Congress requested money from the states, but most states denied the request. So perilous was the status of the army that they often lived day to day. The only choice left to our government was to borrow funds. Haim Salomon, who became a very successful currency broker, used his financial savvy to finance the revolution. Salomon offered his own personal funds, estimated up to $600,000 to the cause of the American Revolution. Today, his loans would have equaled a fortune of tens of millions of dollars. When the British Parliament authorized undercover financial schemes to undermine the colonists, such as creating counterfeit money and discrediting American delegates to Holland and France, the British were hoping to cause a mutiny in Washington's army. But Salomon came through again with personal loans and brokered finance deals both in the New World and elsewhere around the world. Salomon also proved his worth as a spy for George Washington as well as a finance man. On several occasions, Salomon was captured by the British, and he used his commanding knowledge of European languages to talk his way or bribe his way out of prison. Reputedly, he persuaded over 500 Hessian soldiers from Germany to desert the British cause for the American side. Salomon also pleaded with Jewish men to fight in Washington's army. Michael Feldberg writes, "Within 5 years of his arrival in Philadelphia, Salomon advanced from penniless fugitive to respected businessman, philanthropist, and defender of his people. He risked his fortune, pledged his good name and credit on behalf of the revolution, and stood up for religious liberty. Despite financial setbacks at the end of his life, Salomon's name is forever linked to the idealism and success of the American Revolution, and to the contributions Jews have made to the cause of American freedom." It is clear that significant Judeo-Christian influences were involved in the founding of our nation. Although, being a nation of all peoples, coming from different backgrounds and cultures, Christian, Jewish, and others did not hinder us. Although it is difficult to verify, many believe that a Star of David on the back of the $1 bill is a tribute to Haim Salomon and the many Jewish Americans who fought for our initial freedom. Faith of our Founding Fathers. Freedom of religion is one of the basic tenets of the founding of our nation. And while we are primarily a Judeo-Christian nation, we are a nation of faith that encompasses many religions and beliefs. We, as a nation, welcome all nonviolent people of every faith, and there was never any intention by our founders of excluding religion from our public or private lives. They did not want us to embrace a theocracy, but neither did they want us to eschew religious principles. Our National Day of Prayer, for example, is a significant part of our heritage. In 1775, during a meeting of the Continental Congress, all of the colonies were asked to pray for wisdom as the policies to govern the nation were being formed. During the Civil War, President Lincoln proclaimed a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer, and in 1952, President Truman signed a joint resolution from the Congress officially creating a National Day of Prayer. Undoubtedly, there are some in our country who are very uncomfortable with the highest levels of our government recognizing and encouraging prayer. But as Mrs. Shirley Dobson, chairman of the National Day of Prayer, put it, "We have lost many of our freedoms in America because we have been asleep. I feel if we do not become involved and support the annual National Day of Prayer, we could end up forfeiting this freedom too." However, in April 2010, U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb in Wisconsin gave a ruling that the National Day of Prayer, which Congress established in 1952 and President Truman signed into law, is unconstitutional. I believe the problem arises from misinterpretation of what our founders intended with respect to government and religion. Having lived in Europe's old world, they were very familiar with the deleterious effects of state-sponsored religion. They never wanted to see the government endorse a specific religion, but neither did they want to see faith and religion suppressed. There's nothing at all in our founding documents forbidding or denigrating religious expression in public life. The judge in this case was responding to the lawsuit filed by the Freedom from Religion Foundation. Their challenge was that the government cannot tell anyone to pray, but perhaps they didn't notice that prayer was not a requirement, but rather a suggestion. A government requirement would be something like paying your income taxes. If you owe taxes and refuse to pay them, you will quickly learn the difference between a suggestion and a requirement. Speaking on the separation of church and state, Joel Oster, senior counsel for the Alliance Defense Fund, added, "The National Day of Prayer provides an opportunity for all Americans to pray voluntarily according to their own faith. It does not violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment." Not only have polls shown that most Americans feel positive about a National Day of Prayer, but interestingly, a Rasmussen report from February 2011 showed that 65% of Americans prefer having prayer in schools. Unfortunately, the very vocal minority trying to suppress religious expression in America has been successful in getting this issue to the top of the political correctness list. Even though most Americans believe in God and many have a strong personal faith, political correctness decries public declarations of that faith. Yet, even both houses of Congress begin each session with public prayer. Because I do a lot of public speaking, people regularly thank me for being bold about my belief in God. If most people believe in God, and yet we are afraid to speak of that belief in public, what does it say about the freedoms that our ancestors fought and died for? At the Constitutional Convention of 1787, Benjamin Franklin, who was 81 years old, gave the following address on June 28th when hostilities and bitterness threatened to totally disrupt the convention. Mr. President, the small progress we have made after 4 or 5 weeks, close attendance, and continual reasoning with each other, our different sentiments on almost every question, several of the last producing as many no's as ayes, is, methinks, a melancholy proof of the imperfection of the human understanding. We indeed seem to fuel our own want of political wisdom, since we have been running about in search of it. We have gone back to ancient history for models of government and examined the different forms of those republics which, having been formed with the seeds of their own dissolution, no longer exist. And we have viewed modern states all round Europe, but find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances. In this situation of our assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. To that kind providence we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We had been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. We shall be divided by our partial local interest. Our projects will be confounded. And we ourselves have become a reproach and byword down to future ages. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter from this unfortunate instance despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city be requested to officiate in that service. The speech apparently had such a profound effect on all present that the assembly voted to begin every session with prayer, a tradition that has continued until this day. I love to drag this passage out when so-called intellectuals claim that Benjamin Franklin was an atheist. Many people like to rewrite history or delete portions to bolster their arguments before gullible audiences. But I am so grateful for people such as former congressional candidate William Federer, who has done extraordinary research to uncover documents revealing the true sentiments and beliefs of our founders. Only through the careful study of historical documents can we prevent the distortion of where we came from and who we are as a nation. Freedom to worship or not worship as one pleases would not be an issue were it not for the extreme intolerance of anti-religion groups. In many cases, these are the very same people who brand anyone who disagrees with their agenda as bigoted and intolerant. Their extreme hypocrisy is almost comical, were it not so sad. I have also frequently heard people question the faith of Thomas Jefferson. However, in his 1781 Notes on the State of Virginia, he wrote, "And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are of the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." This passage, and many others like it, leave no doubt about Jefferson's beliefs. There are many more convincing statements by other founding leaders, such as George Washington, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, Daniel Webster, Thomas Paine, John Locke, James Madison, and others that make it clear there was never any intention of removing God from the public sphere of our nation. Remember all the controversy in 2003 surrounding the order given by a United States district judge to remove the Ten Commandments monument from the rotunda of the Alabama State Judicial Building? A similar thing then happened in the courthouse in Jackson County, Kentucky, where the Ten Commandments had to be removed in response to a lawsuit. Statues, nativity scenes, and other religious objects have also been removed by zealous opponents of anything that has to do with God. Somehow, the people initiating these lawsuits believe that making these objects visible to the public violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution, which says the legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion. They conveniently forget about that part of the amendment that follows, saying that the government should not prohibit the free exercise of religion. The infamous lawsuit instigated by Michael Newdow in Sacramento sought to remove the phrase "under God" from the Pledge of Allegiance. But if these kinds of activities don't constitute the prohibition of free exercise of religion, then what does? Until the anti-religion zealots learn the meaning of the word tolerance, we will continue to experience unnecessary strife. What message are we sending the next generation when a student is not allowed to express himself freely? In the Morgan v. Plano Independent School District case, also known as the Candy Cane case, several students were denied their free speech rights and discriminated against because their speech was religious in nature, including a young boy who was singled out and banned from handing out candy cane pins with a religious message at his class winter party. A little girl who was threatened for handing out tickets after school to a religious play. And an entire class of kids who were forbidden from writing Merry Christmas on holiday cards to American troops serving overseas. On appeal, the government officials are now arguing that elementary students are too young to have First Amendment rights. If anyone is still skeptical about our roots as a nation of faith, consider the fourth stanza of our national anthem. "Oh, thus be it ever when freemen shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, when our cause it is just. And this be our motto, and God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." Is it any wonder that God has blessed America to such a great extent? We acknowledge him in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, in our Pledge of Allegiance, in our courtrooms, in our national anthem, and on our money, to name a few things. In return, he has blessed us above all nations just as he said he would. Before we throw away those blessings, remember what George Washington said. "The man must be bad indeed who can look upon the events of the American Revolution without feeling the warmest gratitude toward the great author of the universe, whose divine interposition was so frequently manifested in our behalf. And it is my earnest prayer that we may so conduct ourselves as to merit a continuance of those blessings with which we have hitherto been favored." Could it be that the father of our nation was not only talking to the people who were his contemporaries, but was also providing a word of encouragement and warning for future generations? Chapter 4, A Different School of Thought. On my first day in Mrs. McQueen's bright, cheery kindergarten class at Detroit's Fisher Elementary School, all students were required to bring a rug on which to sit while we happily learned new songs, games, and facts all day long. Since my mother was, and still is, so thrifty, she was able to supply one for me, in spite of the fact that we didn't have much money. At the time, I didn't think about the fact that it probably came from either Goodwill or the Salvation Army. I was simply excited about the new experience and the opportunity to play with so many other children. Kindergarten, first, second, and the first half of third grade were not particularly rigorous. School was mostly fun and games. I was an average student, and life was peaceful. After my parents got divorced and we were forced to move to Boston, we lived in a tenement not far from Franklin Park and the zoo. My brother Curtis and I walked through the park every morning on our way to parochial school, which had only two classrooms. There were four grades in each classroom, and all eight grades were taught by only two teachers. Consequently, the vast majority of our time was spent singing songs and playing games. By the time my mother, Curtis, and I moved back to Detroit, I had essentially lost a year of school while in Boston, my academic performance lagging far behind that of my new classmates. To make matters worse, I was the only black kid in the class. In those days in Detroit, academic expectations for a black boy were not very high, particularly in a predominantly white school. After every quiz, each student had to report his or her score out loud for the teacher to record, and classmates always snickered after I announced my abysmally low scores. Although they teased me a great deal about this, none of them ever had to worry about getting the lowest score on a test as long as I was in the classroom. You might say I served as the class safety net. Needless to say, my self-esteem began to follow my academic expectations of myself in a downward spiral. I would even laugh along with others at some of the jokes about me. To cope with the ridicule, I smiled a lot and tried to adopt a nonchalant attitude about being the class dummy. I secretly admired those who always knew the answers and were the last ones out in the spelling bees. I never imagined that I could be smart, let alone win a spelling bee. The low expectations everyone had for me, including my own expectations of myself, would certainly have predicted a dismal future for me. Fortunately, my mother, with her third grade education, was terrified that because of our poor academic performance, both my brother and I would end up with low-paying, menial jobs as she had. She didn't know what to do to help change our path, so she asked God to give her wisdom on how to inspire her sons to work hard and make something of themselves.